Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Spring is finally here, and while we're enjoying the sunshine, the warmth, the green, the early blossoms, we've invited entomologist Laura Iles here to be a buzzkill. She is the director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, and we're going to talk about some of our most recent invasive insects. Hello, Laura.
Hello, Charity.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. Let's dive right in, because we have a lot of species that people are worried about, that people are very aware of. I think we should start with the emerald ash borer. What's our latest?
Right. So emerald ash borer, which feeds on all species of ash, has been found now in 57 counties in Iowa. So we've added four more counties just in 2018. So this is the one that, you know, if you have an ash tree right now that you really need to be thinking about, do you want to be doing treatments or not? Do you want to be removing that tree and getting greater diversity in our yards and our streets?
All right. So it's pretty much everywhere is what I'm hearing.
Well, not quite everywhere. You know, we still have the 57 of the 99 counties. So there's still plenty of time. And even in counties where there are infestations, oftentimes it's in one city. We were just discussing it's in Storrs City here in Storrs County, but not yet in the city of Ames. So that gives residents of cities or areas where it's not found yet this time to be, you know, kind of analyzing their tree canopy, thinking about how to increase that diversity, to plant something else, and then to, you know, just kind of start to budget and think about if you want to apply treatments to your ash tree or not, and what that long-term commitment to protecting the ash tree is.
All right. And we've got a forester joining us in a few minutes. So if people have specific questions about specific trees, I'm sure he is ready and willing to field those. Again, what are we looking for with the emerald ash borer? I mean, you get reports about it, but as people are out looking at their ash trees, what do they see that show them that they might be there?
Right. So emerald ash borer, the beetles start and the female lays her eggs in the top of the tree. So it's actually the top of the tree, especially with the green ash that will get declined at the top. And then it's kind of like an ash tree bush, kind of like in the middle of the tree. You just see a lot of leaves there because you get a lot of epicormic sprouts. So they're just kind of like the water sprouts. The tree's just trying to put out leaves and trying to survive. And then over several years, the emerald ash borers move down the tree. So you'll see that decline starting from the top, and then you start to see a lot of woodpecker feeding because the woodpeckers are coming after the insects. So you'll see a lot of, we call it flecking, but they basically kind of are flecking off the bark to try to get at those larvae under the bark.
And can you actually see the insects?
Sure. If you, if it's really extensive and all the way down to the trunk, literally the bark will just kind of fall off because it's completely fed on the tree right underneath the bark. But if you peel off the bark, you can see the winding tunnels, and it's an infested tree. It's not very hard to find the larva there associated with the tunnels.
Is there anything we don't know about the emerald ash borer at this point? I mean, it's been making its way across the country. Other states have gone through this before. We have, are there surprises left?
I am sure there are surprises yet left because it's an insect, of course. And I think the big thing that we're all kind of waiting to see is, you know, as we introduce biological controls, as populations are kind of settling out, what the kind of long-term trend will be if we continue to have very large populations or if it kind of settles down and, you know, it's not quite as big a problem as it is right now. And I think that's the big question, like long-term, do we have to continue treating trees every other year, or can we start to extend that treatment period or not?
Well, and you mentioned, for example, that it's been spotted in Storrs City, but not in Ames at this point. How does it travel? I mean, some people, we have these in Michigan, where I used to live, I saw the ash trees die across the state. But in Iowa, we have these large open fields, and it seems like that would stop it.
Right. And so, you know, emerald ash borers are really, you know, any insect that kind of moves with people like the emerald ash borer, it's always kind of an interesting movement pattern. So this is an insect that on its own, a female, well, she'll mostly just fly to the next ash tree. But, you know, she's really kind of limited to, you know, a few miles that she'll fly herself. You know, and certainly there's a few capable of long distance. But the big movement has been people, firewood, is probably one of the biggest things. That's why I always talk about burn it where you buy it. Don't move firewood. It's not only emerald ash borer. There's a lot of other insects and diseases that can potentially be moved around on firewood.
All right. So that's a good behavioral guideline
yes.
for us people who love to camp. All right. Let's move on to some of the other invasive insects. Let's talk about the brown marmorated stink bug.
Yeah, so I always feel a little bad because it calls like the doom and gloom and the insects are all bad. But, you know, when we're talking about the invasive insects, there's not much positive to say. So the brown marmorated stink bug is another one. This one is an accidental invader. So if you've had a fairly large brown stink bug in your home last fall or, you know, right this time of year as we get warmer weather, that is likely to be the brown marmorated stink bug. We have reports of it in 25 counties now in Iowa.
And what does it do?
So it feeds on a lot of different species of plants. All stink bugs have those kind of piercing, sucking mouth parts. So the damage is usually discoloration. They love to feed directly on the fruit, you know, apples, tomatoes, peppers, sweet corn, soybeans. So it's a really broad host range pest. And then they come into homes in the fall, unfortunately, similar to the multicolored Asian lady beetle and box elder bug.
All right. And any advice for when we encounter these bugs?
Well, unfortunately, it's very similar advice to our other kind of fall accidental invaders. At this point, just removing them and getting them out of the house via vacuum and things like that. But they don't smell very nice. And there's really no treatment that you can do for them once they're in the house.
All right. And what's the projected path? What do we expect to see happen?
If we're similar to states to the east of us, we expect to see populations increasing, getting increasing reports of them in homes. Currently, most of the reports, you know, people are, you know, sometimes finding a handful, sometimes, you know, enough to be kind of a nuisance, like 10 to 20 of them. But yeah, certainly as we turn to the eastern U.S., there's people with thousands upon thousands of them in their homes, and it's an incredible issue.
Now, with these insects, both the emerald ash borer and the brown marmorated stink bug, I mean, obviously they're not native to Iowa. Do they have predators?
Right. So many invasive insects, when they arrive, yeah, they don't have any of their predators with them or their parasites or the diseases that where they're from help keep their populations under control. So they've really kind of, and that's one of the theories of why they might be invasive, is they've escaped all those natural predators, and their populations are able to just increase to these huge sizes, making them these very big pest issues.
Let's talk about another one. How about the spotted wing Drosophila?
Yeah, so the spotted wing Drosophila is it's a small fly. It looks very much like our normal fruit fly. If you've ever had, you know, fruit going bad in the fall and you get all those little flies in your kitchen, the spotted wing Drosophila looks very much like that. The male has spots on the wings. The problem with the spotted wing Drosophila is it doesn't just attack decaying fruit. It can actually lay her eggs into unhealthy fruit on the plant. And the big one in Iowa is the blackberries and raspberries. So if you're growing blackberries and raspberries and have struggled with tiny little white maggots in them in the past few years, it has probably been the spotted wing Drosophila.
Where is it in the state?
We actually don't track this one. Our guess is everywhere. This is an insect that just came into the Midwest, into the U.S., and just spread so rapidly that there really wasn't any tracking at all after the initial reports, because it just seemed to be everywhere we looked.
So is there anything you can do if you've been struggling with those little maggots in your berries?
Right. So it's primarily, again, the raspberry and the blackberries, the day-neutral strawberries, sometimes tart cherries, aronia, a few others. They're not species specific. It's kind of any fruit that they can lay eggs in. The big things are sanitation. So picking cleanly, even picking off fruit that are, you know, you're not going to eat because they're ugly, getting rid of them. Don't just compost them, actually remove them so that the flies can't emerge from them. Picking up dropped fruit and things like that. There's certainly insecticides available, but you have to be pretty careful using products because you're using them so close to harvest, and you have to be very careful watching, reading those labels, making sure they're labeled for what you're treating, and watching those pre-harvest intervals, because if you spray too close and it's a long harvest interval, you could lose your whole crop just because you're not able to harvest it.
All right. So this has been a lot of doom and gloom. You want to give us a little bit more? What's on the horizon? Are there other insects we're looking for?
Oh, yes, there are always other insects. Probably the one that's getting a lot of attention right now is a spotted lanternfly. That's an insect that's just out in the eastern U.S. So that's one that we're kind of making people aware of. It is usually first found on Tree of Heaven. So if you notice, you know, some rather large, strange-looking insects on your Tree of Heaven, give us a call. And then it's kind of just always important that everyone really, you know, if you see an insect or something that you really haven't seen before, it's so important just to get in touch, you know, with, you know, the us or, you know, the DNR, the Department of Agriculture, because that's how these invasive species are found, is just someone noticing something different and giving someone a call.
So if you notice something, do you try to take a picture? Do you try to get a sample?
Yeah, good question. So definitely a sample is best, and if not, a picture, because we really can't do much with just kind of a verbal report. So physical sample and or pictures if you can.
And how would I collect a physical sample? Do you have some advice for the layperson?
So, well, you know, I guess if you're, because most people don't like to touch insects, you know, I usually just grab a jar. If it's not going to fly or anything, you can just kind of, you know, knock it into the jar and put the lid on it. At that point, you can, you know, put it in your refrigerator or freezer to kill it if you want to get a picture that way. That's probably the easiest way to capture most insects unless they're fast flying.
All right. And any hope on the horizon, Laura?
Well, no, I mean, I think insects are fascinating. And, you know, as devastating as these invasive insects can be, you know, it's fascinating seeing, you know, that they can come into a completely new habitat and cause this sort of damage. And I think as we, you know, get better at working with these invasive species and increasing our diversity in our trees and things like that, that, you know, hopefully we're hoping to have habitats that are more kind of resilient to what will be just continuing waves of different invasive species.
All right. Well, stick around, Laura. And if people have insect questions, I'm sure you'll be willing to answer them. Entomologist Laura Isles, she is the director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. Coming up in just a moment, horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension will be here, along with DNR forester Mark Vitosh. And you are welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today and spring outside. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Laura Isles. She is director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. Richard Giron is here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
And this morning I went for a walk and I thought about just not coming back because it's so beautiful out and all of a sudden I see things in bloom. What are you seeing in central Iowa, Richard?
It's still pretty limited. Basically, we have some daffodils. We have the Siberian squill. We have the witch hazels. The silver maples are blooming. Not very noticeable, but they are. So a few things, even maybe the pussy willows. So
nice.
A few things.
Very nice. And Mark, what are you seeing out when you're in the forest?
Well, in the forest, the Virginia waterleaf is starting to come out of the ground. I've seen a little bit of hepatica. I can see the green leaves of it. But it's just like Richard said, it's still, I think they're not ready. They're like, is it going to snow still? Should I wait?
I think
they just don't believe it.
Right. They don't believe it's actually going to warm up. But I think with the temperatures coming, I think we're going to see a lot of things happen in the next 2-3 weeks.
Absolutely. I went out. I saw just a little bit of my bluebells are starting peek up
above the
surface.
Yeah.
So in a couple of weeks, we'll have some gorgeous blossoms. Yeah. All right. Let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number. And Dan is on the line in Ames. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk
about? I had a question about the emerald ash borer. I had two questions, but one was about the emerald ash borer and this treatment that they're using. How soon did that come out, and has it been effective on the eastern states like Illinois and Ohio?
Right. So the treatments that are available are very effective. So as long as the tree is overall a healthy tree with good canopy, it needs that leaf tissue to move the insecticide up throughout the tree. So as long as it's a healthy tree and they're applied correctly, it is very effective. It just has to be applied either every year or every other year, depending on the label.
And let's get a little input from Mark here as well. If the treatment is effective, when you make the decision to start treating a tree, I mean, that's a pretty long-term commitment, right?
It is. I mean, the stuff that's available right now, the stuff that's going to last the longest is a 2-year treatment based on the label. So you're basically going to have to treat that tree every 2 years. And if you stop, then that tree is going to become more susceptible to that. The key thing for me is you got to make sure that tree is treatment worthy. Is it a quality tree? Is it in the right place? What's the age? What's the health? How well is it growing? Is it a risk tree already? Does it have issues that you look at that tree and say, well, maybe I shouldn't even keep this tree anyway? So a lot of times we have to make sure we're not treating a tree that's already going downhill, that's already unhealthy. If a tree is unhealthy for other reasons, then the treatments will maybe stop emerald ash borer, but they're not going to stop other problems. So it's really important that you get that tree evaluated to make sure it's a healthy tree and a good candidate for treatment. And again, this gets me in trouble sometimes, but really in our urban areas, the average age for ash trees is probably somewhere between 40 and 70 years. There's always exceptions. There are 100-year-old ash trees out there, but if you have a tree that's 50, 60, 70 years old, maybe starting to decline, that may not be the best candidate for treatment. But if you have a healthy tree, as Laura said, these treatments seem to be working. And Iowa State has a really good publication called Emerald Ash Borer Management Options, and it talks about these different chemical treatments, when they need to be applied, what they are, how often, and those kind of things. So that's a really good information out there for people. Need to do some of that research themselves too.
What do we know about the environmental impact of these treatments other than on that one tree?
There's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, the Forest Service has a really good publication out there that has looked at some of those. And so far, there haven't been any specific negative impacts, but if you go to emeraldashbore.info, they have a publication called Frequently Asked Questions Regarding Potential Side Effects of Systemic Insecticides Used to Control Emerald Ash Borer. And that really covers even related to birds and water quality and some of those things. Now, we do know that some of the chemicals that are still available, and maybe Laura can talk specifically, there are some of these home treatments that if you use, you specifically do not want to use around flowering plants and others, because that chemical can be picked up and actually get into those plants, which can impact bees. And maybe Laura can talk about that more specifically.
Yeah, Laura, you have something to add?
Right. So the smaller diameter ash trees, a soil-applied drench systemic insecticide is effective at protecting small ash trees. But because it's soil-applied, that insecticide will be picked up by any flowering plants near the ash tree. So we don't recommend it being used if there's any flowering plants near the tree at all, because it would be picked up by those plants and potentially harm pollinating insects.
All right. And Dan, you had a second question also.
Well, just to add to that question, I have honeybees on my acreage. I have lots of ash trees. And the ones I have cut down in previous years, they already have signs of borers in them. But would that insecticide affect my honeybees when the ash tree's flowering?
Right. So that is a good question and a good concern. Honeybees will collect ash pollen. It's not a very, you know, they don't produce nectar and things like that. So they're not, and they're wind pollinated, so they're not as highly visited by bees. But if it's kind of the only source out there, but there has been a lot of research done on this, and that we haven't seen impact on honeybee health from this. But that's a good question and something that we're continuing to watch.
Okay. My other question was about asparagus rhizomes that I bought a couple weeks ago. And about a week ago, I was going to plant them, and I left them out on my four-wheeler. And I'm pretty sure they got froze a little bit from the cold nights we've had. I was wondering if that would destroy those rhizomes.
Well, I would check them. If they're basically soft and mushy, I would assume they basically froze and they've been destroyed.
Sure.
If they're still solid and firm, I would suspect they're still alive. Get them in the ground as soon as possible.
All right, Dan, thanks a lot for your call. Let's go to Lou Ann in Cedar Rapids next. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hi. We have those little bitty ants, and I was out in the living room, and in the carpet there was this spot, and it was all these little bitty ants that had came. How do we get rid of them out of the carpet? We have, you know, had them in the past, and like in the kitchen, they come up from the vents underneath.
Mm.
You know, they're like the greasy ants.
Yes, yes. So the grease...
But... Go ahead.
No, so grease ants are particularly attracted to any foods kind of with greasy in it, so more crackers mm-hmm. and things like that. My suspicion is there was something there on the carpet that they were attracted to and feeding on. So the ant baits work for grease ants, but you do usually want to mix something in them because the ant baits are kind of sweet. So, you know, mixing them with peanut butter or something like that can help make them more attractive to the grease ants and get better control that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And how can you get them out of the carpet? Because I cleaned the area where the spot was. Mm-hmm. I think it was ice cream that was, you know, spilled there. And then I went back about 5 minutes later, and they were just sick again. So I vacuumed them all up and, you know, so...
Yeah, I think you're doing exactly what you need to do. Unfortunately, you know, with spills, sometimes they go down in the carpet. And because the ants found something there, they kind of, you know, they leave pheromone trails and they go back and forth to the colony and say this is a place for food. So it takes them a little bit to pass along the message that there is food no longer there. So I would go ahead and vacuum them up and then clean the area and the area around it. And you shouldn't see it being a problem for very much longer.
All right, Lou Ann, thanks a lot for your call. Next, we'll go to Teresa in Des Moines. Hi, Teresa.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have two cherry trees that are faithfully bearing cherries, but they're very old. They've been there for 40 years. And I don't expect them to live forever, but I want to know what can I do to help them continue to bear cherries for as long as they will?
Basically just good care. Make sure that nothing injures them unintentionally. Prune on any dead limbs. During prolonged dry periods, maybe water the trees. So basically just good care.
No fertilizer?
No, I would not. No, they typically don't need that. Most soils in Iowa contain enough nutrients for them, so they're fine. So don't see a need to do that. And in fact, if you fertilize the lawn on occasion, you're indirectly fertilizing the trees too. So I don't see a need to do that. But when we have these prolonged dry periods, when they're under stress, maybe some water.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I would also avoid any major changes to the site around those trees. As trees get older, they don't like a lot of change. So don't decide to put a new walk in, a new path, anything that might cause compaction around it.
Or a raised bed or anything like that.
Avoid changing the drainage in the area. So maybe they used to get water and now they don't, those kind of things. So just don't disrupt, as Richard said, what's worked so far. As long as you don't do that, that'll help it along.
All right. Teresa, thanks a lot for your call. And next we've got Lightning in Ringsted. Hi.
We are, dear.
Hi.
Lightning. Good morning.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, this past year is the first time I experienced a problem. I think it was earwicks eating off my marigolds, those I planted like from four packs, transplanted them, but also I planted some sunflowers from seeds, and it gets so tall, and next morning they were chewed off. I thought maybe it was rabbits, so I put a fence around that, didn't do it. So I think I saw some evidence of earwicks under rocks and stuff in the area, and I'm wondering how I can, if that's the problem, and what kind of an insecticide or something can I use on them?
Right, so earwigs can be a very common problem. They will come up and kind of feed on flowers. They wouldn't, you know, cut off the flower or anything like that. They don't even really chew through the petal. You'll just see kind of this scraping pattern. So if these are pots or things like that, I recommend getting them up off the ground. So you're reducing kind of the hiding places, those wet places underneath the pot, things like that. Insecticides can be used, but you can't use them on the flowers themselves. So they can only be used on the foliage of the plants because you don't want to use them on the flower. Obviously, it's not labeled for that, and then it would harm pollinating and beneficial insects.
Oh, okay. I was thinking of like on the ground around them, even just to keep them from crawling up.
Yeah, because the difficult part is that insecticides either have to come directly in contact with the insect or be consumed by the insect. So for the most part, it's better if we put them on something that the insect's going to consume. Depending on the cover, things like mulch and stuff can really absorb the active ingredient pretty quickly, so you won't see much activity for very long.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Rob in Iowa City. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I have two questions about box elders. First question, maybe an old wives' tale, but I've read or heard that spraying outside the house in the spring is a bad idea because in the fall they enter the house seeking warmth, and in the spring they're attempting to get out, and you're preventing that exit. And the second question is, does it do any good? You may have addressed this. Does it do any good to spray for box elders inside the house, or is that just a futile effort?
All right. Box elder bugs, we've got a lot of insect concerns today.
Yes, of course, because insects are really cool, except when they're in your house and
right.
trying to get out. So in the case once box elders or any other accidental invader is indoors, it's not necessary to treat. You know, vacuuming is just as effective. It doesn't, you know, solve any problems. The big thing is to use insecticides outdoors in the fall. So you're exactly right. This time of year is not when you want to use insecticides. It wouldn't really do any good. So the big thing is to watch for those fall days. To, you know, focus first on, you know, window screening and sealing cracks around windows and doors where they might be coming in, and then using an insecticide, you know, on those things to try to deter insects from coming in. You're never usually going to stop all the insects from getting indoors, but you can reduce the number coming indoors.
All right. And I have to ask, I know a lot of people really dislike box elder bugs, largely, I think, because of their large numbers, the way they congregate. But what do they do? Do they do anything that we need to be concerned about?
No, they don't do anything that we need to worry about. They don't hurt us. They don't feed on our food. I mean, they're just looking for a good sheltered space to spend the winter, and they don't even realize it's our house. They're just finding a place. They're not that smart to know that, you know, it's a house. And in fact, the heating indoors and the dry air indoors during the winter causes them to die a lot. So our homes are not the best overwintering habitat for them.
All right. And if you can keep them out of your house and they congregate on your house, will they just move on?
They should just move on. And most of these insecticides are meant just to be irritating to the insects. So they just move on and we don't get those congregations.
All right. Rob, thanks a lot for your call. You are welcome to join us on the line. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a comment from Taylor. He called us a few weeks ago. He said, I called to ask if dog urine would kill dormant grass. Just thought I'd let you know that as the grass has begun to green up, I now have dead patches. So it would seem it can happen. All right. So he also follows up with a question. He says, last summer, I planted some boxwood bushes. A couple of them have had leaves turn greenish yellow. One of them isn't too bad, but another has a decent bit of the leaves turning mm-hmm. color. Can I expect them to green back up?
It depends upon the amount of injury. Boxwoods are kind of finicky, that if we have a tough winter, you can see some browning in late winter, early spring, either due by the sun or the wind, which kind of dries out the foliage. So if you see no signs of green at all on certain portions, I would suspect those portions are dead, and I might prune those out. To maybe verify that, I would maybe take a stem and try to break it or snap it. If it's dry and brittle, it's dead, and I would prune out the dead areas.
All right, and he's wondering if he should give them a fertilizer or something like that.
I don't think I would at this point. Again, what I might do later on this summer is if we have some dry periods, make sure it has some water to help the plants recover.
All right, here's a question from Cliff in Iowa City. He says, every fall, raccoons tear up huge chunks of sod in my yard. I've been told they're looking for grubs.
Mm-hmm.
When and how often should I treat for these?
Well, that's one thing they do, and they can be quite destructive. Prevent that, you could put on a preventive type insecticide, typically in late June or July. And if you do it then, if you water it in or if it rains, then it should be in the soil as the eggs hatch, and it should immediately destroy the grubs.
All right, and here's a quick question from Emily. Would it be okay to transplant peonies this weekend? We live just south of State Center.
Okay. It's tough, but if you're going to do it this spring, you want to do it as soon as possible, because the bigger they get, the more difficult it is. When they're made basically 6-8 inches tall, it becomes very, very difficult. So do it immediately if you can, and hopefully they'll be okay. Make sure they're well watered this spring and summer.
All right. Is there a better time of year to transplant?
Actually, yes. September, October is much, much easier.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, and entomologist Laura Isles. She's the director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We're enjoying warm spring weather. Things are starting to grow, and you can call with your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron, DNR Forester Mark Vitosh, and Laura Isles, Director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. And I'll do a few email questions here, then we'll get back to the phones. Here's an email question from Becky. She says, I was wondering if you have any suggestions on how to address a rather large yellow jacket underground nest in our yard. Laura?
So yellow jackets don't overwinter. So the queens just overwinter, not the whole nest. So hopefully there won't be another nest there this year. If it is another nest, it's a nest that's been established by a different queen. So you do want to watch for activity, and then a dust insecticide in the entrance of the nest at night is the best control. Now, you don't want to do this if you're allergic to wasps or bees at all. You can certainly hire a pest control operator to do this. But placing some dust insecticide right at that entrance at night, and so then during the day, the wasps track that and move it down into the colony, and that usually will provide control as long as it doesn't rain right afterwards.
All right. Here's a question from Janine. She says, my hydrangea plants leaf and grow beautifully, but no longer flower very much. Mm-hmm. Any hints for me?
Well, I'm guessing it may be a big leaf hydrangea, and they tend to bloom very sporadically. They're not very reliable. The white flowering types that are very common, they're very reliable. As far as these big leaf hydrangeas, the only thing you can do is go out there in the spring, let it leaf out, and then cut out only the dead wood. Some of these bloom on old wood, some on new wood. So if the actual wood is still alive, leave it. And if it overwinters, then there's a better chance it's going to bloom that year. But the big leaf hydrangeas are kind of finicky as far as flowering.
All right. And here's a question from Cindy near Ames. And it's a kind of a complicated one. She says, most plant species have certain insect species that feed and depend entirely on those plants. I assume that is true of ash trees, as ash trees disappear from Iowa. And the only remaining ash trees are those protected by powerful insecticides. Will those ash dependent native insects disappear from the state? I think this is probably a little more complicated than Cindy's question implies. But Laura, you want to take a first crack at that?
Right. So, you know, any time that we're looking at, you know, the loss of, you know, a native plant, that is one of the concerns, is the native insects that are reliant on those and, you know, exclusively on those. A lot of insects will be on several different species, or at least everything in that genera. So for the most part, what we expect is that we'll still have a lot of ash seedlings that, you know, that won't be completely extinct. It will just be not nearly as prevalent as it is. Although, and I can also point out that, you know, we've planted a lot of ash in our and along our streets and things like that. And so that's when we're really seeing that devastation from emerald ash borer. It's because, you know, we've planted in some cases far more ash than we should have when we don't have much diversity. So I wouldn't expect to see that we'd have a complete loss of those insects, but we're definitely going to see some changes in their populations.
All right. And is there a possibility that when someday all of the ash trees that we have are dead, will the emerald ash borer also disappear from the state?
We wouldn't expect that. We would expect it to be more similar to like Dutch elm disease, where it, you know, it moved through devastating, very similar to what emerald ash borer is doing right now, and then just kind of festers out there. And the hope is that, you know, 50 years from now, that we might have more resistant species of ash. We probably won't have anything that's, you know, 100% immune to emerald ash borer, but we get, you know, some varieties that are more resistant and we have better options out there.
There's some early studies in Ohio. we listened to a Forest Service employee talk this winter, and they're seeing some potential natural tolerance or resistance, whatever you want to call it. But in some of their devastated areas in their woodlands, they still have ash. They still have seedlings coming. And we see the same thing with elm. I walk the woods all the time and still see many, many, many elm, because just like ash, it produces a lot of seed. And if they're not attacking the smaller trees, they're still coming. And they may have to get a certain size before the ash borer really attacks them. So I agree with Laura. I think there's potential that the species is still going to kind of try to hang around as things occur.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Glenna is on the line in Newton. Hi, Glenna.
Good morning.
What's your question?
We recently were gifted with a lot of hollyhocks that are around the house of a property where the buildings are going to be destroyed. We want to transplant the hollyhocks to the property where we live. What is a good location, and is there any secret to the depth or the distance?
Well, they basically like full sun, so at least 6 hours of direct sun, a well-drained soil. They'll grow actually pretty well in even poor soils. So it should be well-drained, plenty of sun. Hollyhocks are actually biennial plants, so they don't survive typically beyond 2 years, but they produce a lot of seed. And so once you establish them, every year new plants come up from seed, so you'll have them forever. As far as transplanting them, dig them up as soon as you can this spring. Keep them well watered for the next few weeks. They should be fine. They should go ahead and bloom later on this summer, produce seed, and then basically die. But new ones will come up next spring from the seed.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Glenna. Next up, we've got Sue in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Sue.
Good morning. I have three questions. I have what I always call heritage plants from grandmothers and other places. And this year I'm having some issues, a couple years ago, with my wisteria. Is it okay that it just loves to live in the trees that are around it? Or do I need to do something to prune it back and keep it contained onto the arbor?
I would keep it contained on the arbor because it gets to be pretty large and it might strangle some branches if it has that opportunity. So I would keep it out of the tree.
Okay. The root system has gotten quite large. Is there some way, I mean, when we moved it here 30 years ago, you plunged the spade into it and at the farm and you just brought it home. Do I need to do this to help contain the size of it?
I don't think I would normally do that. I would just prune it back severely. That's probably the best way to contain it.
Okay.
It tolerates pruning quite well. So.
Oh, yes, it has for 30 years. So. But it did become quite, and I was smart enough to plant it way away from the house because, you know, they are very strong, and as you said, they can do a lot of damage to get to shingles and things, but I wasn't sure about the trees, so it was very lovely hanging up there out of the trees and blooming, so I'll get that taken care of. I'm doing some construction this year, and I have another heritage plant that's a hydrangea bush that's several years old, and I would like to save it and move it. Okay. It'll be about 30 days from the time that construction starts until I can put it where it should hopefully live the next 30 years. What can I do to help this poor, lovely thing survive?
Okay. I would dig it up as soon as you can while it's still dormant without foliage.
Okay.
And one thing you could do is get a big tub.
All right.
And very carefully put it in the tub, keeping as much soil around the root system as possible. And then maybe put it in a shady area and keep the soil ball moist so the roots don't dry out. and then as soon as you can, put it back in its new site. So just keep it, make sure the soil ball stays moist, it doesn't dry out, and kind of out of the sun, out of the wind, and it should be okay.
All right, Sue, good luck with that. Thanks so much for your call. Next up, Annie in Des Moines. Hi, Annie.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
So my question is, I have a large maple in my backyard. We've lived here for about 5 years. And over the last couple of years, it started to kind of thin at the top. The leaves don't get as large, I would say, as they used to, and it turns yellow before the rest of the trees in our area. So I don't know if this is a sign that it's on its way out or if there's anything I can do to try to help save it.
Well, what anytime you have decline on any size tree from the top down, we often start to think about the root system. There's some type of damage to it, or we might have what we call stem girdling roots. If it's a bigger, mature, one thing you may want to look at is down at the ground level. Look to see if there's any roots that seem to be growing around parts of the trunk or strapping over other portions of the root system. That can often cause girdling. If you don't see that, anytime you start to get, especially if the tree is starting to drop leaves earlier in the year, there may be some type of root damage. So one thing I would actually do is try to get an arborist, a certified arborist with the International Society of Arboriculture, and go online and see if there's local arborists in your area and have them inspect that tree to see if they can see anything around that. There's some diseases. There's actually a disease called verticillium wilt, but you often see the yellowing or the browning of that in the summertime. So if I'm seeing a lot of times too, they'll start to leaf out later than normal, and then each fall they'll kind of drop their leaves earlier. If they're doing that, then you may be looking at some type of root stress or root damage.
All right. Does that help you out?
It does, yes. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Annie. Next up, we've got Marilyn in Eldora. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. I have a question for Mark.
All right. He's ready.
Okay. I live on an acreage, Mark, and we've ordered the songbird packet from the State Forest Nursery.
Yes, ma'am.
They will arrive next week. We will be protecting the four trees from deer and rabbits. I wondered if I need to protect all the 16 bushes from deer and rabbits or just from the deer.
If you have a lot of deer and rabbits and you know that they cause damage to a lot of things, I would say the more you can protect, the better.
Okay.
So on the shrubs and stuff, maybe just a smaller cage to keep things off. But I would say if you know that you have animals out there, especially deer and rabbit, if you can protect them. The good thing about the shrubs, if you can do that for a couple years and then get them established, a lot of times you can pull those fences off and they'll withstand some of that damage because they're shrubs and they can. But
right.
I would say if you know you have issues, if you can, I would try to protect as many of them as you can.
Okay. All right. Can I ask one other question?
Sure.
Okay. We have an old apple tree that produces really nice apples for us. We have two others on the property that are at least 500 feet away from the old one that we get the produce from. But the one of the older ones that's nearby that we don't harvest anything from has quite a large limb that's kind of leaning over, and we'd like to be able to cut it off. Are we too late?
No, you can do that. Typically,
okay.
I'd want to do that before it begins to leaf out, and because of this spring's weather, they're kind of late this year. So I would do it maybe this weekend, early next week.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Mark.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for your call, Marilyn. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Bob is on the line next in Tipton. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I've been collecting coffee grounds for a while and drying them, and now I have about 3 5-gallon buckets of dry.
All right. 3 5-gallon buckets of dried coffee grounds, and you're wondering what you can use them for? Oh, I think he dropped off. That's his question. Are they useful in the garden?
I think I'd be inclined to basically put them in a compost pile with other plant debris, maybe some food scraps like banana peels, that type of thing, and maybe later on maybe some debris as you clean up the garden this spring, add that to it. So basically, I think I'd add it to a compost pile.
All right. So not on their own?
Not directly, right, no.
All right. Here's a question from Steve in Windsor Heights that is not going where I thought it was going. He said, a couple of years ago, I cut down a row of honeysuckle and it grew back and flourished. Can I do the same with a burning bush? And is it too late to do so?
They're not as resilient as the other plants are. So I would say you can still prune it, but I wouldn't cut it back more than a third. So you could remove maybe one third of the plant, but leave the rest. It's not as resilient as some of the other plants.
All right. And there, I thought that we were going to talk about honeysuckle as an invasive
species. Well, I wanted to throw something in. Yeah. And I wanted to say, I would suggest, Steve, think about some other native shrubs to put in areas and then eventually take those out. And actually, believe it or not, burning bush is becoming an invasive plant in our native woodlands also. So we actually have native wahoo, which is very similar, that could be planted, but I would look at some of the native alternatives and long-term maybe consider eliminating those plants and looking at some of the natives.
All right. You've been out struggling with honeysuckle a lot for
honeysuckle
years.
And burning bush and barberry. I mean, a lot of these plants we use in our landscape are really starting to become issues.
All right. Here's a question from Bob. He says, is it okay to trim my bush that grew a lot last summer and fall right now?
Well, you probably can. Knowing what it is, though, would be helpful as far as to what extent. Now, if it's a spring flowering shrub and a fairly young plant, I guess I would be inclined to let it go ahead and bloom this spring and then prune it immediately after bloom. If it's more of a, let's say, a dogwood where the flowers are not that ornamental, then they could definitely do it right now.
All right. And here's a question from Lori in Des Moines. When will I know if my hydrangeas survived the winter and what do I look for?
Probably not until around mid-May. And I would just look for signs of growth. I would expect to see that hopefully by early May, but it may not be until mid-May before you see any signs of life. If you see nothing at that point, then it's not very encouraging. I wouldn't pronounce it dead, though, until probably the end of May.
All right. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, how far behind we are our usual spring schedule. How far behind do you think we are?
About 2 weeks, I think.
All right. All right. So don't get too impatient.
Right. Just be patient. Wait. And wait until the end of May, if necessary.
All right. The morales are still coming. I promise. They're coming.
And hopefully we'll have beautiful weather to hunt them. Okay, I will try to get this one in quick. This is from Kathy. She says, my horse decided to walk through my front yard. It walked through my flower beds last week. He left deep marks in multiple plants. Do I dig these plants up and try to bring them back up to their original height, or do I just leave them be?
I think I'd leave them be.
All right.
Maybe by themselves, they'll kind of, you know, freezing and thawing and things like that. That might take care of it.
All right. And hopefully the horse will stay out of the flower beds from now on. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Laura Isles.
Thank you.
And Laura Isles is director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Mark Vitosh, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And you're going out to plant trees this afternoon?
Actually going to plant 100 oaks today. Yes.
All right. Mark Vitosh, DNR Forester. We'll be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.